Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Josh Robinson, a permaculture practitioner from San Diego, though he's traveled much wider than that, who is part of the team that operates the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. Their organization is devoted to doing on-the-ground permaculture education and as a hub to connect people with information and ideas about various sustainable practices in the San Diego area. When Josh came to my attention, I was fascinated by the amount of classes and workshops being offered by the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute, and then in scheduling the show, by his passion for teaching and sharing permaculture. With our time together, the conversation covers his own long passage to permaculture, the work of the Institute, and some dry land permaculture techniques. Along the way, his love of all these things and his experience come through. If you like this or any other episode of the Permaculture Podcast, please help me out. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and find out how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter and how you can make a one-time or small recurring monthly donation. Also, take 2 minutes and leave a review on your favorite podcast site. Every bit helps to spread the word. Now then, on to the interview with Josh Robinson. I'll join you afterwards with some updates. If you're ready to begin, I always like to ask first-time guests for a bit of their background and biography so people can know who you are. If you could give me that, and then that can lead into our conversation about the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute.
My name's Josh Robinson, and I was raised in San Diego and grew up kind of typical of many folks these days in the suburbs. And you know, I came to permaculture a little bit later in my life after college. I was a business major starting off and going into that because that's what my dad did and following in his footsteps. About my third year in college, I ended up going out to Alaska, and that was kind of one of those life-changing experiences where I was working out there in the summer and just kind of realized that there's a whole nother way of life beyond the suburbs, beyond business, and came back to San Diego and I switched my majors into more geography. And it wasn't because that was the field I really wanted to be in, but somebody told me that you could be a park ranger if you went into geography. So let's go ahead and try that. So I feel like I learned quite a bit about the basics of physical geography and weather patterns and that kind of stuff. And after I graduated, I still had no idea what I was going to do, but I realized that I wanted to get more into sustainability. That was the field that I was drawn towards. How does one live a more sustainable lifestyle? Now, and growing up in the suburbs, we don't always have those teachers, those role models, see what's around us, and that's basically the lessons that we learn. So I began to look around, and really this is the start of where I was at. 2001 is when I graduated from Humboldt State, Northern California. From there, I began to look for internships and began to look around, and I started hearing a little bit about permaculture and natural building. I was really fascinated by straw bale building and ended up finding an eco village that was very small at that point called Dancing Rabbit Eco Village in Missouri. And decided I'm going to do an internship there and learn about what an eco village is, to grow food and all of those types of things. I went out there for about 4 months, I guess in 2002. And it was an eye-opening experience to see people in small rural area building their own houses. In this part of Missouri, there were no building codes, and so it was unique. People just trying out all sorts of techniques from straw bale to cob to whatever they had, timber framing and all that kind of stuff. There were on-site gardens, so people were really raising a lot of their own food, and there'd be a lot of people coming through that were fascinating folks. It was also the first time I got to use a composting toilet. There were learning about Joe Jenkins, and we had the Humanure bucket toilet out there. Dancing Rabbit also had a fantastic library, And so I began to kind of read a lot of their books. And one that was fascinating to me was the Permaculture Designer's Manual. Dancing Rabbit at that time wasn't really looking so much at permaculture, as far as I could tell at that point. I wasn't really versed in it at all. But that book, browsing through the pictures and everything, was just completely fascinating. When I left Dancing Rabbit in the fall of that year, I came back to San Diego. And again, still not sure what the heck I was going to be doing with myself. I was really enjoyed my experiences and the lessons that I learned there about building and growing food and all that kind of stuff. And I was also feeling a little depressed coming back to the city. I think a lot of folks, especially in the city, we are taught many times that global problems, we have no way to address at the local level, that that's somebody else's job. I went down to the funky part of town in San Diego, the Ocean Beach area, and there's really a beautiful food co-op there that's been around since the 70s. And on the wall there was a sign that mentioned that Yonto Evans, Cobb building guru, was going to be speaking that night at the co-op. So I jumped on that opportunity. I've been hearing his name all at Dancing Rabbit, and I went and saw him, and he just gave the most powerful, simplistic, elegant talk that I had ever heard up to that point on really just ecological design, tying the building environment with the natural environment, with the gardening, all of that. At the end of that, he mentioned that there was a permaculture class happening in about a week or two up in Northern California, and just felt that that was my opportunity, and I jumped on it. Went up to Northern California, did the two-week intensive with Penny Livingston, Starhawk, Eric Olson. Incredible course, really life-altering. You know, I think a lot of people have that experience. It sounds like for you, Scott, that it was also a similar point in your life. After that, still wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do in my life, but I had this framework, this permaculture understanding that was my mission. That was where I wanted to be. And I moved out to Tucson, Arizona, essentially right after that class, and began to apply some of those things right in my own life. Pretty intense garden began to set up in the house that I was living in. I was introduced to Brad Lancaster pretty much the first week. He lived not too far away, and seeing some of the interesting stuff that he had going on there, I began to take on little odd jobs doing like garden stuff and irrigation technician and whatnot. And I did that off and on for the more or less 2 years that I was in Tucson. Also ended up sometime during one of those summers up at the Llama Foundation for one of their Build Here Now programs, where it was more or less about natural building. But I went up there as an intern, so I spent about a month or two helping out, getting the prep for that. Back to Tucson, still felt like I needed to take what I was doing to the next level. I began to look at grad school, thinking that maybe I need a little bit more of this educational knowledge. And so I applied to a bunch of schools and ended up choosing Prescott College in Arizona. I also, at the same time, moved up to Flagstaff, Arizona. I really had a hard time with the heat of Tucson. It seemed like Flagstaff was the next place to be. And so I moved up there. I was able to do my master's program at Prescott, distance learning, so I'd only have to go down there twice a semester. And I ended up getting a master's at Prescott in ecological landscape design. For those who aren't familiar with the Prescott program, it's really to create your own distance learning degree. And so you can come up with the topics that you want to study, and you create a curriculum around that, and you work with an advisor and some other folks to make sure that you're completing that work. And so essentially what I did was created a permaculture degree more in the landscape field. And that for me was the next reincarnation of my understanding of permaculture. I was reading a ton of books at that time and then trying to do a lot of writing and condensing thoughts, ideas, and then also out there practicing this even further and in a different environment. So moving out of that Tucson kind of low desert to more of a high desert mountain environment, much different than the environment I grew up in San Diego. After I graduated, I wanted to get more into the landscaping field. I've been doing it more or less informally. Once I finished up, I basically formed an ecological landscape design company based in Northern Arizona. And I teamed up with two permaculture folks at that time, Chris Anderson, who's since moved on from the area and doing great work out east in the Midwest, and Karen Taylor, who has gone on to Southern Oregon, is now teaching permaculture up there with a number of folks around that region. So Eden on Earth was a company that really started to pioneer and bring water awareness issues into the landscaping field in Northern Arizona. Our specialty was rainwater harvesting and gray water systems and using that water to irrigate edible landscapes. So we had jobs just putting in vegetable gardens or food foresty kind of stuff, lots of gray water systems, lots of rainwater systems, trying to emphasize more of the passive strategies for rainwater as opposed to the tanks. But, you know, we did what would pay the bills. And during those years, learned a lot about what I didn't want to do anymore, which was the contracting aspect. We were same time teaching classes, basically right when I finished up with Prescott College, began, even while I was in Prescott College, starting to teach introductory classes in permaculture. So much of our marketing for Eden on Earth was just going out and doing free class on what permaculture is or what rainwater harvesting is or gray water, soil building, or whatever it was, just getting out there and trying to explain to people what they could do in hopes that, you know, we might get a job out of it.
You were using your permaculture knowledge and going out and teaching as a way to market and grow the knowledge of your business?
That was one aspect, yeah. Teaching smaller, you know, an hour talk at the library or whatever that was. Another team that I was involved in Flagstaff, you know, I basically got into teaching about permaculture in that area because nobody else was doing it. I never thought I would come into that teaching aspect. I used to be terribly afraid of speaking in public in front of people. I was like that guy in high school and, you know, elementary school that when we had to do a presentation was just heart racing and beating. But I was so passionate about spreading this knowledge and seeing that really there were nobody else in the area that was doing it. And so teamed up with a few folks there early on. Matt Berry, who's kind of moved on to Northern California and been teaching with Penny Livingston and other folks up that way. And Lisa Rayner, who is a true gem in the Northern Arizona region, right? Flagstaff, written books on high elevation permaculture strategies and gardening. So we formed a small teaching team starting to do just basic permaculture courses. And over the period of a few years, it began to stretch into full design courses. I think the small area, we had really good allies in the community college system. And even at the university level, Northern Arizona University began to pick up on this pretty unique situation. So I guess I'm jumping around a little bit there, but with the teaching aspect, it was two parts. One, passionate about teaching permaculture, just getting the word out there. And the second portion is just more or less the marketing aspect, kind of a stacking of functions.
It's quite all right if you jump around. One of the interests that I have right now, because of much of the contact that I'm getting from listeners, is about the stories that people tell about how they came to permaculture and the place that they are now, with where you began and where you've gone to get to where you are now shows the long path that it's taken to get from those early days to here. And I know that in my own story, it took about 15 years for me to get from my first introduction to permaculture to this moment in time. And that for some folks who have just run into this material or are new to it, it can be kind of intimidating to look at something like the designer's manual, which you found so inspiring in your early work and is something that really caught my attention early on as well. When you see something like that, it's not always inspirational. It can be intimidating to think that you need to know all this or learn all this to start to apply the material of permaculture. Now, thankfully, over the last decade or so, there's been a lot of good introductory material that's produced, a lot of those one-hour workshops, weekend workshops, very reasonable books you can pick up and read through. But this story of your experience, I think, is an important part of getting folks involved in permaculture. So I do thank you for taking us through all of this.
Yeah, I mean, likewise, what you're kind of echoing there is it is a journey. And really, it's a life and how you get from one place to another. And rarely is that a straight line. Just like wind moving through a various pattern, it's kind of oscillating a little bit forward and then it kind of jumps back a little bit. And inevitably, you get where you're meant to be. And that's more or less the empathy, I guess, of my permaculture journey within that realm. So taking from that basic wanting just to learn more and leading into just putting in gardens and doing that handy man little bit of gardening into a higher education, doing what that means at the academic level, and then oscillating back into a contracting design aspect, which is simultaneously happening with an educational teaching component. Teaching has been one of those things that I feel like I've learned more about permaculture through. To be able to teach it, you really have to understand it. And some things don't really necessarily happen until you begin to think about, well, how can I explain this to others? My current path from there is felt like I've reached my peak in terms of being able to influence the region through contracting. It was an invaluable experience in terms of learning like hands-on, this is what works, this is what doesn't work, tweaking systems, understanding that. But when you move into a landscape design business, what I realized early on is my passion is actually doing the work. But 90% of that work of having your own contracting business is not necessarily in the field. Trying to sell jobs, marketing, connecting, rubbing elbows with folks, trying to find out where that next job's going to be. What I found much more rewarding was that teaching piece of it. I felt that's where my calling began to come into play, where if I can influence just a few people to go out and do what I was doing, that is going to have a much greater impact than just working at somebody's house, putting in a rain tank or gray water system. Those things are cool and can have direct impact, but it's not as grand as it really could be. And it's not at the pace that I really want to see things moving. I spent 8 years in Flagstaff, and I think that place was a great trialing place to learn about teaching, to learn about applying permaculture. It's, I think, one of the harshest places in the U.S. to really try to grow things. I never thought I'd end up back in San Diego, but I would come out here every winter and either do some teaching or do some working. And about 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I started teaching a permaculture design course in San Diego. And coming out here after those 8 years was an eye-opening experience. Growing up in San Diego, when I wanted to learn about sustainability, permaculture, natural building, I had to go out somewhere else to learn these types of things. What I found really amazing coming back to San Diego was that this was starting to pop up all over the place. And yet nobody was really teaching permaculture. There were a lot of cool gardens popping up here and different groups coalescing around food issues and community issues. Teaching the course, I was able to come and see all this. And leaving Flagstaff, 2 feet of snow on the ground in winter, coming out to San Diego, and I'm in a t-shirt for a lot of the time, and realizing that I miss San Diego, and that there was a niche for this right here. My path has been kind of to try to get into areas that don't necessarily have this information and begin to create those bridges and create that educational stream. So I moved back to San Diego about 2 years ago and wanting to, well, not really sure what I was going to do, actually. I just knew I didn't want to do contracting and I knew I enjoyed teaching. And after seeing the layout, doing a little assessment of the region, realizing that San Diego is really ripe for some sort of institute or some sort of place where people can come and learn about permaculture and all the different techniques and strategies, things that they can do right now and have a global effect. And so about a year ago, we formed the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. We're a nonprofit. We're a program actually of the one-to-one movement, which was forming at the same time there. And our mission with the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute is to try to teach these hands-on sustainability topics to people to show them that they have the potential to solve global environmental problems through local backyard small-scale solutions. So try to make people a part of the solution, right? So we're always talking, you know, the problem is the solution. And what has so drawn me to permaculture is the upbeat, positive approach that saying, no, this is what we can do to show that kind of mission. So we've been going for about a year now. And during this time, we've taught over 60 classes and we've reached over 900 people bringing up issues of permaculture, sustainability.
In browsing your website, I saw the number of classes that you're teaching, which is rather impressive because every few days there's something going on. And another part of that is also the amount of on-the-ground local information you have connecting people with not only what it is that you're teaching, but also resources within the community to make a difference. What I mean by that is I saw for your rainwater harvesting installation class that you also have information about the city of San Diego giving rebates for water storage. And I know that that can make a really big difference for trying to put in some kind of a reasonably sized system, that you're not going out buying those 55-gallon blue drums and linking those together. But with that kind of a rebate, you can buy a very nice-sized project-specific tank for storing water. And I think that that connection, as you say, building those kinds of bridges are really important, connecting people not only with the techniques, but also the additional information and incentives to make that happen.
The San Diego Sustainable Living Institute, as we envisioned it, was this place that we would be able to draw people in from the community to create that physical networking hub where we bring in the regional and local experts in whatever topic that is and trying to pull those pieces together so people don't have to look all over the place. It's all just in one spot. And so a lot of these classes are being taught by people that have been in the field doing it, people that have businesses doing it. And like you're saying, we're trying to provide the resources that make it easy for people to jump into these. You mentioned the city of San Diego's rebate program and the great incentive for people to get started in rainwater harvesting. I think a lot of people, when they hear the term, get excited. And the first thing that comes to mind is that sexy rain tank. And the rebate is one of those things that would more or less encourage that. I'm still a fan of more of the passive strategies, which have, I think, a larger potential for more water savings. But yeah, being that kind of hub. I like to say that we work from a bottom-up, top-down approach. So bottom-up, training the residents to take personal responsibility and begin to implement these strategies all on their own, but also looking at it from a top-down side. So working with the local government to try to see how we can make larger movements and connections within the community. So we're currently working with a few city council folks on some gray water to be able to facilitate the sharing of that information. But we also work with local businesses to try to eliminate some of their waste streams and ideally turn them into resources and products. So we have a couple of small enterprises where we're taking things like used vinyl from print shops where people make banners. Rather than just sending that to the landfill, we're able to take it and we work with local seamstresses to turn that into usable functional products like reusable tote bags or wine carriers or six pack holders or wallets. And we can then ideally raise a little bit of extra money to help fund our programs, but it's kind of reinvesting that back into the business. We also work with a local coffee company where we're taking their coffee back and keeping those out of the landfill and also turning them into bags and other types of products. So bottom up, top down.
Talking about looking for additional ways to bring in income streams for the Institute, are you at a point where the workshops and other work that you're doing is self-sustaining? Or are you still looking for some additional growth to get yourself to a firm footing?
Now, we're still really in the infancy. We teach a lot of courses. A lot of them don't always. We charge a little bit of money for each of these just to keep that going. We are a nonprofit, but we do not have any grant funding at the moment. So basically, all the support is for people coming out, taking a class. We do get a few donations. But we're trying to diversify that to be able to basically support the work that we're doing. Currently, everybody that is working with the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute is more or less a volunteer. We do pay the guest instructors that we bring in. So regardless, they still get paid for their courses. But things that I'm teaching or other staff we have, at this point, we're still looking for those funding sources. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you for that bit of candor and sharing that with us. It's one of the things that, looking at the very large umbrella that permaculture casts and many of the different things that people can do within that for a career or working within the community that's still trying now as that permaculture flower opens up and blossoms and many of us are within it now, finding those different ways to make different models work within the world of business and the society that we find ourselves in, where we still need to make dollars and cents in order to move forward with our next project. So as I talk with folks about that, I'm interested to hear about those pieces and see who has what portions working and how. So thank you for that.
It could be almost thought of in that model of growth where we're still in the pioneer phase of permaculture, where to really get it, you have to be that weedy species that's coming in there and really prepping that soil for this next generation. When we have certain kind of invisible structures in place that various economies, getting in there can be a challenge, but hopefully in the long run, those types of endeavors are going to pave the way for this whole new economy, this whole new way of doing business, and that they are profitable or at least worthwhile, and people are continuing because it's the right thing, that they're able to have a living, whatever that means for them.
And defining that idea of living is a very important part of that. As I was reminded recently, it's, well, you may sit down and say, well, I'd like to start a business that makes $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year. But then the next question should be, do I really need that much? Or is that just a figure that is being thrown out there to find out what one's real needs are in order to make a go at something like this more viable?
Exactly. Yeah, I've never gone into any of these endeavors for the money. I do it because I'm passionate about it, and I can't see myself doing any other thing. I don't just take a job because it has the bills. I've never felt that was my role. I just get depressed if I'm in that realm. And even if I'm not making money, but I'm enjoying what I'm doing and I'm meeting all my basic needs, I've never gone without monetarily. Some people might say, well, I live in the poverty line, but I live in a wealthy social and physical lifestyle. I have a beautiful house that I'm able to rent here with amazing gardens. I have such an abundance of food that we're giving away food. We have just that much, and it's a lifestyle that is really, truly rewarding.
You found a way to look at the world through an abundance mindset as opposed to being caught in that trap of scarcity.
Exactly.
That seems to be a running thread in conversations with several of my other guests about having that mindset of abundance and the difference that that can make just by changing the way that you think and look at the world in living a open and fulfilling life. That it isn't necessarily always about money. There are other ways to meet these other needs that are just as important, if not more so, for our long-term emotional and mental health. That's something that I could probably spend hours and hours talking with you about. But I did want to touch on something a bit more technical as part of our conversation because of your experiences in Arizona. And that was setting up this interview. I had spoken with Andrew Millison, a mutual friend of ours, and he had mentioned that you had experience with dry land techniques. And I would like, if you could, to touch on some of those techniques and, if you will, your dry land principles for people who are living in more arid environments.
I grew up in arid areas, you know, San Diego, dry land environment, although much different than Arizona. Spent nearly 10 years in Arizona trying to understand how to kind of live within those means. The most critical issue, I think, for any dry land system is really designing for water. Water always being the limiting factor in a dry land environment. You know, basically, it's what defines a dry land. You know, you have evaporation over precipitation. So more evaporation than you have water that falls. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum, really, of dry land. So currently, you know, I'm living in San Diego. We have, on average, 10 inches of rainfall a year, right? And all of that falls primarily during the winter. So it's a seasonal winter rain, summer dry. But we have a lot of kind of cloud and dew cover, and there's a lot of moisture that I think condenses out of that. I wouldn't be surprised if we get twice the amount of water here just from fog and that kind of stuff. Arizona is different. You have much higher evaporation rates. You know, Tucson, for instance, gets 12 inches of rain a year, but they have evaporation rates of nearly 10 feet, right? So quite exceeding their water budget. So water is so critical to life. That's the one thing that we have to first and foremost design for. So whether that's trying to harvest and store water, catch it, slow it down on a property, but also minimizing the evaporation and providing for shade, anything that's going to conserve that moisture. So really, all of our strategies primarily are that water realm. So, you know, we're using lots of, you know, and if we're talking about garden kind of structures within the dry land, passive water harvesting earthwork, kind of like a no-brainer. That first level of patterning is like, okay, where is the water coming from? How can we slow it down, spread it out, and sink it in? know, how much water do we have? What is our total water budget? Do we have kind of a, you know, a house that sheds water into one area? Do we have a hillside that comes down and has that potential to bring water onto our site? Those are the things that I'm always looking for. In terms of further iteration on water, looking at other sources from, you know, how can we reuse that water that we already have? Rainwater systems are a tremendous strategy that will factor into almost any living situation. Right? It's kind of one of those things, if we're already using water, why not use it again and essentially double the use of water with only half the water? Right? So if I'm taking 50 gallons of water to wash my clothes, I might as well use that 50 gallons of water to irrigate some fruit trees. So I get 100 gallons of use out of only 50 gallons. What else can I say about kind of the water stuff? Do you have any particular questions that are coming up for you, Scott?
I don't at the moment, because as I think about the number, I'm still caught up when you say that San Diego receives 10 inches of rain in the winter, because I'm in Pennsylvania. I receive around 42 inches of rain every year. And I'm just thinking about why water issues are what they are elsewhere in the country. And it goes back to a conversation that I had with Jude Hobbs and Andrew Millison when I was in Oregon, because we were talking about water rights and mineral rights. And from the conversation we were having, I guess mineral rights weren't that big of an issue in Oregon, but water rights were. And that was really the first time that I had had a conversation directly with someone who was impacted by water rights issues. Because here in Pennsylvania, it's like, well, the water falls out of the sky. We got enough. Don't worry about it. But in turn, because Pennsylvania is a water-rich state, we don't have conversations about gray water systems unless you're really involved in like sustainability, because it's just not something that our Department of Environmental Protection worries about. The couple of gray water systems that have been installed are just looked at and they go, eh, there's no real need for this, so we're not going to license anymore. And as a result, all gray water in Pennsylvania, well, really, as far as the DEP is concerned, from conversations I've had with several of the, I don't want to call them commissioners, I guess they're the inspectors and some of the engineers, as far as they're concerned and as far as the Department of Environmental Protection for Pennsylvania is concerned, there is no gray water. There's no such thing as gray water. They don't consider it. It's all black water. As soon as a human being has used it for some purpose, it is now black water. Even for a washer or washing dishes, that you can't install a system like that without getting fined if they catch you. That's where I'm kind of stuck mentally with dry land techniques, is because I can sit and think about it, but it's just a mental exercise for me. It's not something I've ever really had to seriously consider. And when you mention passive water collecting systems, the earthworks, where I am, because of how water rich we are and how in many areas how high the water table is, and just an example of that water table issue, I actually have a shallow well that winds up getting recharged by the stream that's near my home. But as a result of that, because of the Giardia in the water, I have to have a UV sterilization system in place in order to drink my water and make it potable because of that flow. So installing something like a swale where I live could wind up having these really harsh ramifications for my neighbor because of flooding and water containment. So it's just such something that's so far removed from my mindset that I don't even know where to begin to ask questions, not living with it. That's my long explanation of going, thank you for the opportunity to ask a question, but I just don't know where to begin.
It's interesting to kind of hear you talking about your issues there of like, oh, we have too much water. and then the issues that plays out. And I think that is very much a product of modern development. I mean, we do have the same issues here in San Diego. It's not that we don't have the water. You know, we have periods where it's too much and then periods where it's too little. But falling in the sky of just about any Western city is more water than we can actually use in an entire year. But because we paved over so much of our landscape, and particularly like even when you're in kind of a wet climate where you're at, we're washing all those pollutants down or that agricultural waste. I believe that water harvesting strategies throughout the entire watershed from top down can really eliminate both of our ends of the spectrum. So, you know, you have too much water that carries too much pollution. Well, if you're catching and storing that and filtering it biologically through soil organisms and trees and plants and all of that kind of stuff, I believe you could probably eliminate a lot of that potential for Giardia or, you know, wetland type ecosystems. I mean, those are like the world's most amazing biological filtration systems and super biologically diverse. And on the other end of the spectrum here in San Diego or other dry land environments, when we begin to kind of harvest that water, yes, we're cleaning up some of that pollution, but we're also storing it for that long term to try to get us through that dry season. You know, it addresses both issues. You know, every winter here now in San Diego, we're hearing about record floods. And it's not like we're getting any more water than we ever had before, but it's just we paved over so much of that landscape that we're fostering the movement of that water much quicker throughout our landscape. And so every year, the San Diego River floods. And every year, people are like, wow, this is amazing. We're having tremendous flooding here, and not realizing that it's really a product of development.
Going back, you know, you're on one side of the country with one set of issues related to water. I'm on the other side of the country with issues related to water. But you mentioned that flooding, and it's, I happen to live in the mountains of Appalachia, and as a result of that, there's a lot of state game land that is currently being selectively harvested for timber. And I've gotten to watch over the last several years as my family travels and we go out the road that we live on in one direction, you can just see these large sections of the game lands having the trees removed. And we've watched as more and more flooding occurs. When I first moved here onto this property with my wife, about a quarter of our yard would flood because we're directly on the stream. And we'd have a little bit of standing water, but the last two times that we've had any serious flooding, it's reached the point where, you know, the Red Cross knocks on our door a couple days later to ask if we've had any damage or if we need any help. And we're like, no, we're fine. Our house is out of the flood zone, but you might want to talk to our neighbors on the hill because we heard that their basements got ruined because of this. And thinking about the impact that that has, well, talking with the folks here about, well, as you guys remove these trees, can we put something back in there? What about building riparian buffers to slow down that water as it's traveling before it gets to the stream to keep out that nutrient flow? Or as with our neighbors on the hill, as that water floods their septic tanks to filter that. It always gets me whenever there's flooding to see see some of my neighbors and their young children playing in the floodwaters. And just going, no, please, if you're going to do that, put on waders. Don't go into this with shorts. Do you know what's in this water? And that, though, to me, reinforces that idea within permaculture of needing to have a sense of place, to understand that we can have this cross-continental conversation about techniques and ideas, but without knowing what's causing these issues in our local environment and why it's happening, that it can be hard to actually implement designs that we can design ourselves out of without understanding that. But that's just a mindset that I keep going over, and that idea of understanding our watershed and the, as you mentioned, invisible structures, the people who we're going to reach out to and connect with in order to build all these different pieces within the permaculture model.
Yep. I mean, watershed understanding is, regardless, I think, of our, you know, climate, it's one of these things that's going to be critical for designing for the future. You know, how well you take care of your particular watershed, and especially as we move into this period of global weirding where we're getting kind of like drought followed by flood, and we're seeing this basically worldwide where, you know, it's just those extremes are kind of manifesting at a much more frequent level. And, you know, permaculture, I think, is there to kind of address that type of stuff. And water being life is that fundamental piece. I mean, there's places I'm thinking about, like in, you know, Georgia, where they're going to severe drought over the last few years. And coming from the West, you know, we're pretty, water poor compared to a place like that. But yet, not necessarily how much water you get, but how you kind of use that water. And, you know, obviously it seems like places that get lots of water don't necessarily value it as much as those places that get very little. And that's kind of, I think, one of the big lessons I learned in Arizona, particularly when you go out and visit some of these more rural areas of people that are either hauling water or relying on what actually falls. And those are the people that really know the value of water, you know, because they're either having to carry it or pump it out or whatever. And it's the total amount of water that they use is a fraction of what we're using here in San Diego and other places.
Water is a word and a resource that we'll have to be mindful of moving into the future, ensuring that we have enough and use it in ways that are meaningful to the environment that we live in. And thank you, Josh, for joining me and sharing your story and talking about the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute and the work that you're doing there, as well as talking about dry lands, water in the watershed. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
Well, I just want to, I guess, throw a little plug out there for the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. You know, we do have a lot of kind of unique programs that we have going on right now. It's the Great Gray Water Challenge, which is an initiative that we started up this year to try to really foster the spread of gray water locally. And so we're trying to train and inspire San Diegans to install a gray water system a day. So 365 days coming up this year, we want to install 365 gray water systems. Doing so could save the region over 5 million gallons of water a year. And so we're trying to put a lot of information about, you know, what gray water is and how to do it out there. So you can check out the website, sdsustainable.org. I think that's really about it. You know, I want to thank you, Scott, for having me here. And it's been great chatting with you about permaculture and water and really just life in general.
And thank you again for taking this time. I enjoy every moment that I have with a guest to learn more about their story and hear from the other voices in the permaculture community and the work that they're doing. And I'll ensure for anybody who's listening that a link to the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute will be included in the show notes and on the website. And also, please, if you're anywhere near San Diego, go check out the site and look at all the courses and workshops that are being offered. There's something new every couple of days. I couldn't believe the number of workshops that you're doing and just the amount of information that's out there that could be useful to San Diegans or anybody else in that area of California. Thank you, Josh, for the great work that you're doing. Please keep it up, and I'll be in touch again sometime soon.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
And that was Josh Robinson. I'd like to have him back on the show to expand on the conversation about dryland strategies. If you live in an arid environment and have questions, please let me know. And for anyone who's heard me mention the online permaculture design course I'm starting this summer, you can see the draft syllabus for the course by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/PDC. Registration will open sometime in late May and is limited to 15 students. If you want to contact me about the online PDC or Josh's follow-up interview on dryland permaculture or anything else, you can do so by the usual means. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or by phone 717-827-6266. From there, the upcoming shows are Eric Tonesmeyer returning to talk about his next big book project, and he could use your help to get things going. In addition to his crowdfunding campaign for that book, we talk about using perennial crops to capture carbon, as well as industrial crops that offer alternatives to fossil fuel-derived products. This is another fun time with Eric, and there's plenty for everyone to take away from the interview. That will be live soon. After that is Pam Warhurst, chairwoman of Incredible Edible, and she joins me to talk about how Incredible Edible is using an all-volunteer corps to plant edible landscapes and to build community, often without permission. Search for Pam Warhurst TED Talk, and you can see the presentation my production assistant James brought to my attention as why she should be a guest on the show. She's just as passionate about this subject in our interview together, and as some guests have done in the past, the inspiration of her story left me speechless, though thankfully because this is a podcast, that can be edited out. They're doing some incredible work in her hometown and everywhere else that this idea has been replicated. That episode will be out on Tuesday, April 2nd. Last for these updates on upcoming shows is that David Holmgren, yes, that David Holmgren, joined me recently for an interview. We talked about the early days of permaculture, which included a large part about his story, and moved through time to the present and looked to the future. He was gracious and easygoing, which led to a very pleasant time together. That episode is scheduled for an April 5th release. And that wraps up this show. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.